from the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Friday and welcome to Washington Watch. My name is Joseph Backholm. I'm a senior fellow for Biblical Worldview here at Family Research Council. It's my pleasure to be sitting in for Tony today and with you. We're going to cover, among other things, Israel on the show today. But before we get to our news items, I want to remind you of an effort taking place here at Family Research Council. We are calling believers to commit to praying for and standing with Israel and for Bible-believing churches to do so collectively on Sunday, May 19th, by dedicating a portion of their worship services to pray for Israel's peace, prosperity, and protection. To learn more about this effort and to sign the pledge, visit prayandstand.com or text the word Israel to 67742. That's Israel, I-S-R-A-E-L, to 67742 to participate in this important effort. Today on the program, as I just mentioned, Israel has responded to Iran's strike against them. Was it enough? Will it lead to more aggression directly from Iran? We'll talk about that today. In addition, the Biden administration has released new Title IX rules that impact education and gender and a number of LGBT-related policies. But one of the most surprising things about these new rules may be what they did not do. We'll tell you more about that coming up later in the program. Also, David Clawson from the Center for Biblical Worldview will stop by to talk about why Democrats do a better job of passing on their political values to their children than Republicans do. Important worldview things to understand that we will cover later in the program. But first, our headline for today. A lot of action on Capitol Hill this morning as the House of Representatives advanced multiple foreign aid packages for international allies, setting up floor votes for tomorrow.
The reality here is that if the House did not do this better policy and process, allowing for amendments on the floor in the process tomorrow, we would have had to eat the Senate supplemental bill. And that is because we were very close, given the timeline of both Israel and Ukraine, to a discharge petition being brought. And a discharge petition, in layman's terms, is that when a number of members or a majority of members get together, they can override the speaker and bring something straight to the floor. That would have happened imminently on the Senate supplemental.
That was House Speaker Mike Johnson speaking to reporters earlier today. We'll go now to Washington Watch reporter Victoria Marshall for a quick update. Victoria, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Joseph.
Now, tell us more. We heard there from Speaker Johnson, but what was your take about what happened on the Hill today?
Yes, definitely. So this morning, the House voted in favor of the rule that will allow them to bring the $95 billion foreign aid package to the House floor for a vote. What was significant about it is that the Democrats actually joined Republicans in voting in favor of the bill. Normally, roll votes are typically party line votes. And so it was a bipartisan vote. So now Mike Johnson will be able to tomorrow bring his separate foreign aid bills, Israel, Taiwan, Ukraine, to the House floor for a vote. And because Democrats supported it this morning, those bills will most likely pass.
Now, because there are multiple conflicts, unfortunately, in the globe, we do have these multiple aid packages. We're looking at Ukraine, looking at Israel, also talking about Taiwan as well and the threat from China. Do you have an idea of how much support there is for each of these efforts? Is there general support for the aid packages? Is one aid package likely to progress while others may not?
Well, I mean, just because the aid package passed the House, or the rule passed the House, Democrats, they wouldn't have passed without the Democrats' Democratic support. So there is enough support among Democrats and Republicans to pass both of those bills. The White House is in favor of this package. So the Democrats really care about funding Ukraine, as well as a lot of the moderate Republicans, same with Israel. So I don't expect them not to pass tomorrow just because of how the rule was successful this morning.
So is it your expectation, as they work over the weekend, and they will be working over the weekend on these packages, that all of them will pass with some form of bipartisan support?
Yes.
Well, we will be excited to follow that over the weekend. And certainly one of the things that'd be interesting to track, if there is Democrat support for this, how this plays in the Republican caucus that Speaker Johnson continues to try to hold together. Lots of political ramifications for him personally, and certainly for the caucus as well as they head into November. Victoria, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me, Joseph.
As I mentioned earlier, the Israeli military launched a counterattack against Iran this morning, striking a military base near the city of Isfahan. The attack marks Israel's first military response to Iran's largely ineffective missile and drone barrage last weekend. The reportedly small scale of Israel's attack has many asking if both sides are seeking to de-escalate the conflict. Joining me now from Jerusalem with an update is CBN News Middle East Bureau Chief Chris Mitchell. Chris, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Great to be with you, Joseph.
Well, Chris, what's the mood on the ground hours after this response from Israel to Iran's attack?
Well, Joseph, I would say a bit of relief right now. Israel has gone ahead and responded to what happened just about a week ago, a historic large, probably the largest in history, the 350 projectiles, cruise missiles, drones, suicide drones, as well as ballistic missiles. So Israel, everybody here knew that Israel had to respond somehow. And the way it has seems to be measured, seems to be sending a message that Israel can't allow Iran to strike at Israel without some sort of response. But it seemed to be calculated in such a way, Joseph, that that it wouldn't put Iran in a losing face, and it wouldn't be put Iran in a position that it would have to respond. So both nations, I think, Israel and Iran, feel like maybe this is the end of this particular round, and I would say cautiously. But one other thing that's been noted over here, Joseph, is that for the first time in 45 years, there's been a shadow war between Israel and Iran. Last week, that war became into the light and out of the shadows, and now Israel's responding. They've crossed some sort of a Rubicon. What it looks like going forward, we'll have to wait in the next few days, weeks, and months.
And I want you to say a bit more about that shadow war. As you mentioned, Iran has been operating against Israel largely through Hamas and Hezbollah. I understand 90% of their funding comes from Iran. So they've been engaging in this for a while. What is the significance, do you think, of the fact that Iran finally decided to launch a direct assault from their home territory against Iran, or against Israel, rather?
Well, obviously, the pretext seemed to be on April 1st when presumably or reportedly Israel attacked a consulate that really was more of a military base there in Damascus, feeling they had to respond somehow. They responded, and some people think might have been a strategic blunder. Because and what some people over here, Joseph, are calling a miracle, 99% of those projectiles, cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, and suicide drones were shot out of the air, either by F-35s, F-16s, and F-15s, as well as the Arrow 3, the Iron Dome, and David Sling. So for whatever reason, Iran decided that it had to respond to that attack on April 1st. But it really kind of exposed some of its weaknesses, and it also served to show the strength of Israel's anti-missile defenses, as well as the cooperation between many nations here in the region, including Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Jordan, as well as Western allies like France, the UK, and of course the United States. And that coalition really seemed to be blunt this historic attack by Iran just about a week ago.
Yeah. Now, it seems, based on Israel's response and the way they chose to respond, that they are okay with de-escalating this. And it seems as well that Iran is going to be fine with that as well. But when we go back to that attack that Iran launched against Israel, Do you think they were surprised by how successfully Israel was able to neutralize their attack? Because presumably, when you attack somebody, you don't attack somebody for the purpose of de-escalating something. But their state of mind right now seems to be, we're not looking for all-out war with Israel. So is there any sense in which Iran kind of expected a successful defense against their assault, and they just wanted to do this to kind of send a message?
Well, you know, some people have postulated that, but I think a number of people here say it was actually 60 tons of explosives combined in all those ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and suicide drones. And that's a hard sell if you're trying to actually have somebody defend against that. It could have been a disaster. And as I said before, many people are considering what happened last week a miracle. People last Saturday night were expecting literally the apocalypse, maybe the beginning of World War III or regional war. Right. And by the morning, they're all deciding, well, do I go back to work or not? So it really was an amazing display of defense. I would add to as well, Joseph, that the message that Israel was sending today, I think, was twofold. First of all, Iran cannot attack Israel, especially the way they did, without some sort of response. And the other message was the attack came very close to an Iranian nuclear facility. Isfahan and Natanz is not too far away as well. And that sends a message to Iran that if Israel wants to attack their nuclear facilities, they can do that. In addition to that, Joseph, it seems like they penetrated what's called the S-300, which is a Russian air defense system. And it seems like Israel was able to penetrate that as well, which sends another strategic message, not only to Iran, but the region as well.
Well, meanwhile, Israel continues their war against Hamas in Gaza. Is the actions, the kind of interactions, the conflict with Israel recently having any impact on what Israel is doing strategically against Hamas?
Exactly. And this is part of the message, too. It seems, Joseph, that because the response was measured and did not, presumably so far, provoke a regional conflict or a direct conflict between Israel and Iran, that right now Israel can go down into the Gaza Strip and eliminate perhaps the last Hamas stronghold in the Gaza Strip in Rafah. And not only perhaps eliminate or capture the leaders of Hamas, as well as perhaps rescue as many of the hostages they can. So I think there was a calculation. Israel, we don't necessarily want a major war with Israel, with Iran right now. We want to take care of Hamas in the Gaza Strip, then maybe turn their attention to the north, to Hezbollah. But I would add this, Joseph, your prayer for in May 19th is so needed. Prayer right now for Israel is one of the main weapons of their spiritual Iron Dome that they need from Christians around the world.
That's exactly right. And Chris, maybe in about 10 seconds, do you think their kind of constrained response against Iran will affect the way the international community is looking at and treating Israel in their conflict against Hamas?
Very much so. And I think that was part of the calculus as well. I think the U.S. and Europe didn't want a major response. So I think that helped strengthen that international coalition on behalf of Israel.
Chris Mitchell, thank you so much for your time.
Great to be with you, Joseph.
Coming up next, more from Israel, as well as further discussions of the aid legislation pending on Capitol Hill, when I'm joined by Congressman Eric Burleson. We'll be back.
Christians must be sure to faithfully think about the issues that have taken our culture and many of our churches by storm from a biblical perspective. Family Research Council's David Clawson, along with co-authors Denny Burke and Colin Smothers, released a new book, Male and Female, He Created Them, a study on gender, sexuality, and marriage to help Christians better grasp the Bible's teaching about these issues. This study presents a biblical view of homosexuality, transgenderism, and marriage. With this new resource, readers will be given guidance on specific specific questions related to preferred pronouns, identity, intersex conditions, and other matters that our churches must be discipling their members to respond to with love and biblical conviction. As part of the study, readers have access to supplemental videos by Dr. Albert Moeller, Dr. Heath Lambert, Reverend H.B. Charles, Dr. Christopher Yuan, Dr. Rosaria Butterfield, and others that expand and elaborate the themes of each chapter. To purchase a copy, go to hecreatedthem.org.
Today we find that global persecutions of Christians is growing more menacing every year. Family Research Council's Leela Gilbert, Ariel Del Turco, and Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin's book, Heroic Faith, shares personal stories from those who have endured religious persecution and gives a close look at the dire situations Christians often face due to dangerous and sometimes deadly opposition to their faith. The book's true stories of persistence and faithfulness amidst crisis offer inspiration and hope. Heroic Faith also provides insights into the ideologies driving the hostility and persecution, what steps the U.S. government might take to help, and how readers can best respond to the struggles of the faithful. It is critical for us to learn from our brothers and sisters who are suffering deeply and to do whatever we can to help. You can get your copy of Heroic Faith wherever books are sold or by going to frc.org/heroicfaith. Again, that's frc.org/heroicfaith. Men are constantly told that there is no place for their thoughts and concerns about abortion. However, this attitude ignores the fact that both women and men are deeply and personally affected by abortion. Furthermore, one does not have to be a woman to know that abortion ends the life of an innocent, unborn child. Every man has a role to play in protecting unborn lives and supporting the mothers in their families and greater community, which is why FRC's Center for Human Dignity has released a resource titled A Man's Guide to Standing for Life. This resource was created to help men positively address the topic of life. This guide will equip men with phrases to utilize or avoid, as well as practical tips for helping to protect life and the expectant mother or unborn child he knows. Every man has the opportunity to be an unborn baby's hero by stepping in to support a mother and speaking up for her child's life. Get this free guide at frc.org/prolifemen to learn more about the important role men play in protecting unborn lives.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Joseph Backholm, sitting in for Tony today. Israel's retaliatory strike against Iran this morning occurred just hours before Congress advanced legislation to send aid to Israel, along with Ukraine and Taiwan. You remember in 2023, the House of Representatives passed legislation to provide aid to Israel, which stalled in the Senate. What can we anticipate for this updated version of foreign aid legislation, now scheduled for a vote in the House tomorrow? Joining me to discuss this is Congressman Eric Burleson, who recently returned from a trip to Israel. He serves on the House Oversight and Accountability Committee, the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, and the Committee on Education and Workforce. He represents the 7th Congressional District of Missouri. Congressman Burleson, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Joseph. Good to be back.
Good to have you. What's your reaction to the developments in the Middle East and specifically Israel's counterstrike against Iran?
Yeah, I think that Israel did a measured response. I think that it was designed to de-escalate, but also to make the statement that you're not gonna get away with attacking a sovereign nation like Israel. And I'm glad that they did, and that they are demonstrating that they have a right to be there.
Now, you've recently been in Israel yourself. You've had conversations with the leadership there. You've seen the damage inflicted on the country by Hamas. What did you take from that experience? How is that informing what you think the United States should be doing in that situation?
Yeah, I think that, look, as a Christian, I was able to go to the origin story of my faith, but I wouldn't have been able to do that if it was under controlled by the Palestinians or people of Gaza. This is because Israel is a peaceful nation. It's a Western-style democracy. They support free speech, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, all of those things that we hold dear here in America. But sadly, that those values are hated by nations that border Israel. One of the things that I took away from the meeting was that whenever we toured a kibbutz, which is basically a community, like a, I call it a homeowners association on steroids, that was in southern Israel and on bordering on the Gaza Strip. And we went door to door, and look, it was the most shocking experience of my life, because I saw bullet holes, homes riddled with bullet holes, homes were burnt up. The photos of these families were there. You knew that they were either dead or kidnapped or worse. And it's just, it was horrific. It was barbaric. And one of the things that was the most disturbing thing that I learned is that there were three waves that came in. The first wave was the elite guard of Hamas. Then the second wave was the rank and file military. And then the third wave were citizens, Palestinian citizens. You know, these are the people that are supposedly innocent, but they came in and they were the ones by the tens of thousands that came in and looted and raped and kidnapped people. In fact, that's one of the reasons why Hamas claims that they can't really account for all of the people that were kidnapped, because they weren't kidnapped by Hamas. They were kidnapped by the citizens of Palestine.
Now, based on what you experienced and learned there in Israel, how important is U.S. aid to Israel's potential success against Hamas?
Yeah, I mean, Israel is an ally to the United States. It's in our best interest, and I think it's the interest of humanity. You know, the Bible says when God told Abraham, he said, you know, he who blesses you will be blessed. I think that America owes it to Israel to defend them, because they defend us. And look, our support of Israel is a lot cheaper than the cost of sending an aircraft carrier over there. So and Israel doesn't need near the support as other countries do, because it's a thriving economy, but it's a good relationship, because a lot of what Israel is purchasing is from the United States. It's from our military contractors in the United States, which benefits the U.S. as well.
Now, you hinted there at the fact that there are other countries who are also facing conflicts, who are also seeking the help of the United States. That all of this is happening, of course, in a political environment. This weekend, Congress and the House specifically will be taking up aid packages regarding Israel and Ukraine and Taiwan. What's your perspective on the future of these aid packages?
Well, I think that they're designed to pass. I think the speaker has gotten the Democrats, enough Democrats to get it across the finish line. I won't be supporting it. While I would support aid to Israel, I've already voted for that, and will vote for that portion of the bill again. But at the end of the day, the United States is $34 trillion in debt. We cannot afford to keep bankrolling these wars all over the world. Particularly when it comes to Ukraine, who's not an ally of the United States. They're not like Israel is, like Taiwan is. I just don't think that it's in our best interest to continue to send a lot of the money that we're sending to Ukraine. In fact, more than half of it is not going to fund, you know, bullets and ammunition. It's going to fund the social aspects of the Ukrainian society, which is not acceptable. Look, people in the United States, we need help. We have our border that's completely open on the southern border. And for months, the speaker had the same views that I have still to this day, which is that we need to focus on securing our border before we're going to pay to secure the border of Ukraine. And unfortunately, he's changed his mind on that.
Congressman, in about 15 seconds, if you can, at the top of the show, we showed a clip of Speaker Johnson essentially saying that if it were not for the current package being considered, a discharge position would have essentially forced the Senate version of the bill on the House. What's your reaction to that?
Well, this is basically the Senate version anyway. I'm not sure that there is any very much daylight between these two bills. One of the more atrocious pieces of this is that the money that was supposedly go to Taiwan, the President Biden can redirect that to Ukraine. We're also sending $9 billion
Congressman,
to Hamas.
I hate to cut you off, but we are at a hard stop here. So I really appreciate your time. We're going to continue covering this when we come back on Monday. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And stay with us when we come back. The Biden administration has released some new revised rules regarding Title IX. We'll tell you why you should care.
Christians must be sure to faithfully think about the issues that have taken our culture and many of our churches by storm from a biblical perspective. Family Research Council's David Clawson, along with co-authors Denny Burke and Colin Smothers, released a new book, Male and Female, He Created Them, a study on gender, sexuality, and marriage to help Christians better grasp the Bible's teaching about these issues. This study presents a biblical view of homosexuality, transgenderism, and marriage. With this new resource, readers will be given guidance on specific questions related to preferred pronouns, identity, intersex conditions, and other matters that our churches must be discipling their members to respond to with love and biblical conviction. As part of the study, readers have access to supplemental videos by Dr. Albert Moeller, Dr. Heath Lambert, Reverend H.B. Charles, Dr. Christopher Yuan, Dr. Rosaria Butterfield, and others that expand and elaborate the themes of each chapter. To purchase a copy, go to hecreatedthem.org.
Today we find that global persecutions of Christians is growing more menacing every year. Family Research Council's Leila Gilbert, Ariel Del Turco, and Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin's book, Heroic Faith, shares personal stories from those who have endured religious persecution and gives a close look at the dire situations Christians often face due to dangerous and sometimes deadly opposition to their faith. The book's true stories of persistence and faithfulness amidst crisis offer inspiration and hope. Heroic Faith also provides insights into the ideologies driving the hostility and persecution, what steps the U.S. government might take to help, and how readers can best respond to the struggles of the faithful. It is critical for us to learn from our brothers and sisters who are suffering deeply and to do whatever we can to help. You can get your copy of Heroic Faith wherever books are sold or by going to frc.org/heroicfaith. Again, that's frc.org/heroicfaith.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Joseph Backholm, sitting in for Tony today. Earlier today, the Biden administration released revised Title IX regulations. This highly anticipated rules update erodes due process for students accused of sexual assault or harassment and now includes gender identity as a protected class. With these rules taking effect August 1st of this year, what does it mean in practice for the upcoming school year? Joining me now to discuss it is Meg Kilgannon. She's the Senior Fellow for Education Studies at Family Research Council and served in the Department of Education during the Trump administration. Meg, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hi, Joseph.
Your reaction to the revisions released this morning?
Well, they are astounding. We knew that this was going to happen because we reviewed the rule when it was proposed in 2022. And there is just so much in this rule. It's about 500 pages long. It's really hard to describe the results of it other than to say that they have completely demolished protections for women. And this rule does actually harm students, both the women especially, but also male students. It's just a disaster.
Well, Meg, remind people the purpose of Title IX originally to help them perhaps see the irony of what this particular revision has done with basically allowing anyone to be a woman.
Well, Title IX is a little over 50 years old, and it was put into place to prevent discrimination on the basis of sex in education. And at that time, the discrimination was against women. There were very few women in medical school, very few women in law school. There were very few sports programs for women that were sponsored by schools. And so they wanted to even the playing field, pun intended, I guess, for boys and girls in schools, men and women in advanced education. So the gains that women have made over the years as a result of this non-discrimination law have been wonderful, right? And This completely undermines that by including gender identity in the definition of sex or sex discrimination. So now a man who claims he's a woman can present himself on the women's team, in the women's locker room, in the women's dormitory, and women will not be able to object to that.
There's another component of this that is very concerning. Many of them are. But apparently the Biden administration is taking a position on pronouns. And they're essentially saying that you must use preferred pronouns. You must not, what they refer to as dead name, which is refer to somebody's name on their birth certificate. Tell us more about that.
It was interesting, Joseph. There was a webinar today on that topic, on the rule itself, right, to explain it. We had a half an hour with the Assistant Secretary Lehman, and she talked a lot about this rule. And someone asked a question in that webinar about why there weren't more protections against dead naming and why there wasn't a more severe punishment for not using pronouns. So there's a lot of controversy over that provision, and the implications of the complications of a rule like this are just incredible, because it impacts speech, it impacts the free and appropriate education rights. I mean, it impacts so many things.
Well, and to that point, many states have taken a position on this question. It's very different from what the Biden administration is saying right now. And they have specifically said that that boys cannot participate on female sports teams. So given that conflict, how do you expect that to work itself out? And will the schools in one of these states face penalty from the federal government for complying with state law?
Well, I think today the education department laid down their marker and said, yes, indeed, you will face a penalty for this. They are going to enforce this rule, and they are going to enforce it aggressively. So I think what they're trying to do here, I live in Fairfax County, for example. You're from Washington State. We've been living under these rules for a long time, right? My county mm-hmm. adopted this several years ago. Washington State went down this road a long time ago. So this is designed for the red states and the red counties who have put these protections in place. This rule is coming for you. It's coming for your kids. They want to enforce this rule in your community, in your school, and on your students and on your family, and they will do it. So this is going to be the subject of lawsuits. I've been talking to friends in this space about the rule today, but it's been pretty quiet because I know that the lawyers are meeting and they are planning their cases to file their complaints about this rule as soon as possible. Yeah.
As they should be. Meg, any sense of what the penalties could be for those who dare to defy this new rule from the Biden administration?
Well, you'll be losing your federal funds. You'll be losing your federal funds for your education programs in your state. Now, where I live, we fund most of our education for K-12 through our property taxes. And that's the case in many counties across the country. So it is the poorest places who will be most harmed by this, because they rely the most on federal funding to bring their programs up to standard. But the implications for higher ed and colleges are significant.
Well, Meg, one thing I'm sure of in all of this, despite all the questions, is that the debate is not over. You mentioned all the lawyers that are gathering. There is certain to be a lot of litigation on this question, and I'm confident that a lot of states are not going to just take this laying down. And of course, we got an election in November, which could change the future as well. But Meg, absolutely, we'll keep following it, and thanks so much for your time tonight.
Thank you, Joseph.
When we come back, we're going to have a worldview conversation with David Clawson and consider the question, new research begs, are Democrats better at discipling their children than Republicans are? We'll tell you more about it when we come back. Stay with us.
Christians must be sure to faithfully think about the issues that have taken our culture and many of our churches by storm from a biblical perspective. Family Research Council's David Clawson, along with co-authors Denny Burke and Colin Smothers, released a new book, Male and Female, He Created Them, a study on gender, sexuality, and marriage to help Christians better grasp the Bible's teaching about these issues. This study presents a biblical view of homosexuality, transgenderism, and marriage. With this new resource, readers will be given guidance on specific questions related to preferred pronouns, identity, intersex conditions, and other matters that our churches must be discipling their members to respond to with love and biblical conviction. As part of the study, readers have access to supplemental videos by Dr. Albert Moeller, Dr. Heath Lambert, Reverend H.B. Charles, Dr. Christopher Yuan, Dr. Rosaria Butterfield, and others that expand and elaborate the themes of each chapter. To purchase a copy, go to hecreatedthem.org.
Today we find that global persecutions of Christians is growing more menacing every year. Family Research Council's Leila Gilbert, Ariel Del Turco, and Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin's book, Heroic Faith, shares personal stories from those who have endured religious persecution and gives a close look at the dire situations Christians often face due to dangerous and sometimes deadly opposition to their faith. The book's true stories of persistence and faithfulness amidst crisis offer inspiration and hope. Heroic Faith also provides insights into the ideologies driving the hostility and persecution, what steps the U.S. government might take to help, and how readers can best respond to the struggles of the faithful. It is critical for us to learn from our brothers and sisters who are suffering deeply and to do whatever we can to help. You can get your copy of Heroic Faith wherever books are sold or by going to frc.org/heroicfaith. Again, that's frc.org/heroicfaith. Men are constantly told that there is no place for their thoughts and concerns about abortion. However, this attitude ignores the fact that both women and men are deeply and personally affected by abortion. Furthermore, one does not have to be a woman to know that abortion ends the life of an innocent, unborn child. Every man has a role to play in protecting unborn lives and supporting the mothers in their families and greater community, which is why FRC's Center for Human Dignity has released a resource titled A Man's Guide to Standing for Life. This resource was created to help men positively address the topic of life. This guide will equip men with phrases to utilize or avoid, as well as practical tips for helping to protect life and the expectant mother or unborn child he knows. Every man has the opportunity to be an unborn baby's hero by stepping in to support a mother and speaking up for her child's life. Get this free guide at frc.org/prolifemen to learn more about the important role men play in protecting unborn lives.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Joseph back home sitting in for Tony today, taking you into the weekend. As FRC continues our Stand on the Word Bible reading plan, join us for the Book of Joshua and order Tony Perkins' new digital study guide, Joshua, Finish Strong. This journey through the Book of Joshua recounts how God's general successfully led Israel into the Promised Land and offers practical insight on how followers of Christ are to fight the good fight of faith. To download your digital copy today, just go online to frc.org/Joshua or text the word Joshua to 67742. Now, the culture feels like it's changing rapidly because it is, but much cultural change is generational, and it's determined by the ability or inability of one generation to pass on their values to the next generation. Well, a recent study from the Survey on American Life discovered meaningful differences in the families that pass on their values to the next generation and those that don't. And part of those differences are partisan. 62% of Americans raised by parents who consistently voted Democrat identify as Democrats today, while 57% of those who had Republican voting parents report being Republican today. Now, also interesting are the gender differences. See, young women raised in Republican households are far less likely than young men to identify as Republicans as adults, less than half, that's 44% of young women with Republican parents report that they are Republicans, compared to two-thirds, 67% of young men. That's a huge difference. Now, why are those who vote Democrat seemingly better at passing on their values? And why are young women so much more likely to reject the values of their more conservative parents? We're going to discuss that, and joining me for the discussion is David Clausen. He's the director of the Center for Biblical Worldview at Family Research Council. David, thanks for joining me today.
Hey, great to be with you again, Joseph.
Well, good to have you. You know, I think we should qualify some of the terms that we're using here. This study is the one that looked at kind of the partisanship and Democrat parents and Republican parents, and we know from a Christian worldview that the our goal is not to get somebody to join a political party, but we know that these lines mean something. And generally speaking, we're painting with a broad brush here. But what is your reaction to this idea that research data is suggesting Democrats today are doing a better job of passing their values onto their children than Republicans are?
Yeah, I think this is really fascinating research, Joseph, and I'm not entirely surprised by it. I do think when you dive into some of the details, you know, the general trend is that if your family is more politically engaged, if children hear their parents talk about politics at the dinner table, if they bring their kids to the polls, you know, if it's a cohesive kind of active political family, whether that's Republican or Democrat, politics is much more likely to be important to the next generation. That was true, Republican and Democrat. But like you said, Joseph, in your opening, it's fascinating to see the difference with Democrats, parents who are committed Democrats, to see that they're more likely to have their children follow them as far as political ideology. And when you think about this, Joseph, I'm actually not at all surprised, because if you think about it, every single cultural institution in this country is a cheerleader for progressive causes and for the values that are pretty much now championed by the Democrat Party. And so if and by the way, the survey looked at ages 18 to 29, so this would be kind of the youngest millennials and the oldest Gen Z demographics. And so, you know, if you're these young people and you're hearing values that are taught at the home, also reinforced online, in Hollywood, in the movies that you watch, in the music that you listen to, it's the same values that are taught in the schools that you go to. I'm not at all surprised, because the values of progressive politics taught in the home by these Democrat-leaning and identifying parents are the same values now that are cheerleaded, again, by almost every cultural mover and shaker and those who operate the levers of influence in our society.
Perhaps one way to look at that is the fact that progressivism seems to be the default position culturally. Is that a fair way of looking at this? That unless you are intentional about training a different worldview, that's going to be what people absorb from the world around them?
I think so, Joseph. And again, we've talked about this on this program many times, but you know, those of us who are theologically conservative Christians, the beliefs that we hold are no longer just seen as outdated or a little old school, but increasingly they're seen as subversive and dangerous, and that we should, those of us who hold these views shouldn't even be, it's not even polite conversation, that we shouldn't be in the public square. And so I do think that these progressive values being championed by pretty much every institution makes a study like this make sense. Now, Joseph, I do think there might be some other reasons for the gender divide that I'm sure we can get into. But I do think this general trend where it makes it look like Democrat parents are better at discipling their children, well, let's be honest, they have a lot more help than conservative parents.
And that is an interesting point, you know. But when I was looking further into this subject, I came across a woman named Anne Michelle who wrote a book called Handing Down the Faith. And it was a similar study, but she kind of looked at not the partisan differences. And that's really what this study looked at, is Democrats and Republicans, but really people who hand down their religious faith. And she looked at everything from Hindus to Mormons and everything in between. And she said, in talking about her study, that the banner headline was that the most instrumental factor seems to be when parents talk about faith with their children, not just when they're in the car coming and going from Sunday school or when they're saying bedtime prayers, but when there's a kind of ongoing narrative just in the course of everyday life. Now, when I read that quote from her, it reminded me, of course, of Deuteronomy chapter 6. And this is Moses' exhortation to the nation of Israel about how to disciple your children. You shall teach them diligently to your children. You shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise, right? It's this idea that discipleship happens not on Sunday morning and not during bedtime prayer, but when you demonstrate that this is an integral part of your life and that mealtime and work time and play time and, you know, recreation time, all of that is undergirded by your faith. And when you do that, that's when children really absorb this. Is that a fair take home from all of this, that for parents to pass it on, they have to demonstrate that this is more than just kind of a secondary ornament in their life, but it's actually a key component of who they are?
Joseph, I think you just hit the nail on the head. I think, and you know, we've talked about, you know, the 16,000 hours that students will spend in classrooms from K through 12 and the implications that has for kindergarten, how, you know, 1 hour on a Sunday morning and 1 hour on a Wednesday night youth group can't possibly counteract what you're hearing in the classroom. But I think you're right. And I think that the passage you just hit, Deuteronomy chapter 6, absolutely. I think Christian parents, again, reading research like this, it can be scary. It can be disheartening. But you, like you said, if Christian faith, your Christian identity really is the core of who you are, and your children know that it's the core of who you are, and it's part of your weekly rhythms, it's part of your regular catechesis and discipleship, I do think that's a big takeaway for Christian parents looking at this, that it is absolutely crucial if you want your children to follow the Lord, to make sure that they know without a shadow of a doubt that your commitment to Christ and to His Word and to His church is the driving force in your life.
And that's frankly how you demonstrate that it's not hypocrisy. Right. You may be imperfect, but it's real and it's sincere and it's an ongoing pursuit. Otherwise, if they think you're faking it, nobody is attracted to hypocrisy. But one other element of this that I think is worth discussing is the gender divide, excuse me, and the idea that young women are much less likely to embrace the conservative value system of their parents. What do you attribute that to?
Yeah, the research pointed out a couple of things, Joseph. Just for the sake of time, I'll mention just three of them real quick. But the moral revolution, the LGBT identification, this was really interesting. As far as Gen Z women, 33% of those who are in that youngest adult demographic identify as LGBTQ, compared to only 15% of Generation Z young men. And of course, the LGBT whole set of issues is more associated with the Democrat Party. So if you have way many, you know, a lot more women, young women identifying with LGBT, you know, marks of identification, that makes sense why they would veer more Democrat. Obviously, the issue of abortion looms large in this. We've seen this even before Roe v. Wade was overturned, but especially since Roe v. Wade was overturned, I think the pro-abortion lobby regretfully and tragically has been very effective in talking about how this is an assault on women's rights and women's health care. And so I do think a lot of young women are hearing this abortion messaging, and it's being effective. And because the pro-abortion position's identified with the Democrat Party, they're leaning in that direction, even if they were raised Republican. And then the one other statistic, Joseph, is that it appears that young women who go to college are much, even if they are raised by Republican parents, they're much more likely after a four-year degree to no longer identify as Republican. It was actually 37% of college-aged women raised by Republican parents but who go to college identify as Republican, compared to 65% who they still identify as Republican, but they didn't go to college. So going to college affects women in a pretty significant way, this youngest demographic of adult women.
There is a growing body of research now indicating a partisan divide between young men and young women. Young women are becoming increasingly left-wing in terms of how far out left they are and how many of them are left. And then young men are moving in the opposite direction, which has concerning implications for the ability to find spouses and start families in the future. But, you know, I have a 19-year-old daughter who is not particularly like, she's not a political activist. I asked her impression about that information, and she said very quickly, well, progressives hate men. Why would they want to be one? And that was her just knee-jerk reaction to that. And, you know, it could be true. That could be real, that when men are told they're terrible all the time, it's like, well, maybe I don't want to be part of your tribe. So that could be partial explanation. But David, before I leave you today, there's one other subject I want to get into. We are going to get Richard Dawkins, world famous atheist, has had some really surprising things to say lately. I want to listen to that and then give you a chance to respond.
Well, I must say I was slightly horrified to hear that Ramadan is being promoted instead. I do think that we are culturally a Christian country. I call myself a cultural Christian. I'm not a believer. But there's a distinction between being a believing Christian and being a cultural Christian. And so, you know, I love hymns and Christmas carols, and I sort of feel at home in the Christian ethos. I feel that we are a Christian country in that sense. It's true that statistically the number of people who actually believe in Christianity is going down, and I'm happy with that. But I would not be happy if... for example, we lost all our cathedrals and our beautiful parish churches. So I count myself a cultural Christian. I think it would matter if we, certainly if we substituted any alternative religion, that would be truly dreadful.
David, world-famous atheist and kind of anti-Christian antagonist for most of his life, claiming that he loves the hymns and the churches and he's a cultural Christian. What do we make of this?
Yeah, a couple things, Joseph. It's so interesting. You know, Richard Dawkins wants his cake and he wants to be able to eat it too. This idea that he likes the trappings of Christianity, the cathedrals, the hymns, all of the Christmas carols. But he doesn't actually, he goes on in that interview to say he doesn't believe a word of Christian doctrine. So he likes the trappings of Christianity. He likes the cultural Christianity without the Christ, which again, that's kind of is ridiculous because you can't have one without the other. But what's driving this, and here's the important worldview implication, is that he's looking around England and seeing that Islam is taking over. I read recently that there's about 6,000 mosques right now currently under construction in Europe. And Richard Dawkins is looking at that, and what he sees in Islam is a totalizing, dominant worldview. And he understands that it's a worldview that makes theological claims, and he doesn't like it. You know, Islam itself, the word Islam actually means submission. It means submission to Allah. And in the Islamic worldview, they believe in coercion. They believe in dominating. Muslim countries have religious police. And Richard Dawkins looks at that, and he's, I think, rightfully gets nervous where he looks at Christianity and he realizes that, you know, the Christian worldview relies on the spirit. It relies on persuasion. It's a very different worldview. And so, again, Richard Dawkins, who's made a career out about antagonizing Christian belief, I think is realizing that when Christianity is replaced by something, well, Christianity leaves the marketplace, it'll be replaced by something. And in Europe and in England, that's increasingly Islam.
David, there's a lot there. It makes me wonder, in part, this is an atheist claiming he's a cultural Christian. But I also think that there's a lot of cultural Christians who just haven't admitted the fact that they kind of live as atheists. But what he does seem to be recognizing is that not all worldviews, not all value systems are equally helpful, right? Progressivism claimed for a long time, all paths lead to God, just have good intentions. Richard Dawkins has come to terms with the fact that not all ideas have the same outcomes, and they're not equally good. In about 30 seconds, does it give us hope if a culture generally comes to that recognition?
I think it can give us hope, Joseph, because I think the Christian worldview is the greatest force for good that the world's ever seen. And I think the loss of the influence of Christianity, people are going to see that. They're recognizing it. Even someone like Dawkins sees that and recognizes that. So I hope that people recognize that. But you can't have Christianity without Christ.
Well, this, I do think, can be a good sign. The truth always ultimately prevails, and this might just be a small victory. Even if it's a very small victory, it's a real one. David Clawson, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Joseph.
Friends, we thank you for joining us today on Washington Watch. Be back with you on Monday. Until then, have a blessed time with your God and your family. Fear God and nothing else.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.